Chapter 2. Like most medical men, Stephen Maturin had seen the effects of addiction, full-blown serious addiction, to alcohol and opium. And like many medical men, he knew from inner experience just how immensely powerful that craving was, and how supernaturally cunning and casuistical the deprived victim might become. It was, therefore, only with the greatest reluctance that he had included one small, square case bottle of laudanum, the alcoholic tincture of opium, alas, in his medicine chest. Once laudanum had come aboard by the carboy, and indulgence in it under stress had very nearly wrecked his own life and Padine's. Now, although he was reasonably sure of himself, he had not the same confidence in Padine. And this single bottle, often disguised and sometimes filled with an emetic, was kept in an iron box, far from the ordinary drugs. A ship had to be provided with a certain amount, since there were cases in which the tincture alone would give relief. And the square bottle was the very smallest that could still be called reasonable, that could be reconciled with Stephen's medical conscience. "It's a curious thing," he said to Martin, turning the key in the iron box, "that a man who knows perfectly well that in decency he must not practice on his friends has not the slightest hesitation in doing so when it comes to medicine. We give strongly coloured, strongly flavoured, physically inoperative draughts, pills, boluses, in order to profit by the patient's belief that having been dosed, he now feels much better. A belief whose invaluable physical effects you have often seen. In this case, I exhibited the tincture in the unusually powerful dose of 5 and 30 drops, disguising it with asafoetida and a little musk, and suppressing its name, since the patient has a horror of opium, while at the same time to deal with the initial stimulation that often accompanies the ingestion of narcotics by those unaccustomed to them, I provided 4 pills of our usual pink-tinted chalk to be taken in the event of wakefulness. The patient, comforted by the thought of this resource, will pass the first 10 minutes or so in placid contemplation, ignoring the slight excitement, and then he will plunge into an oblivion as deep as that of the 7 sleepers, or deeper. I flatter myself that this deep peace, this absence of vexation and irascibility, will allow the organs to carry on with their usual task unhindered, responding to mycologogs, eliminating the vicious humours, and restoring the former equilibrium. The 7 sleepers, however, had not been brought up from boyhood with a ship's bell. At the 2nd stroke in the morning watch, Jack Aubrey flung himself from his cot on the leeward roll and staggered, dazed and half-blind, to the starboard chain pump where the hands were gathering. He took his place, tall there in the twilight, with the warm air wafting his nightshirt. He said, "Good morning," to his dimly apprehended neighbours, spat on his hands and cried, "Well!" This horrid practice had begun long ago, well north of Capricorn. So long ago that the people no longer looked upon it as a grievance, but rather as part of the nature of things, as inevitable and perhaps as necessary as dried peas. So long ago that Jack's hands were now as horny as his shipmates. Stephen's would have been equally harsh and rough, for since he had unwittingly set the whole process in motion, he felt morally obliged to rise and toil, and he did rise and toil, nearly destroying himself, until the captain very kindly told him that it was his duty to keep his hands as smooth as a fine lady's, in order to be able to take a leg off like an artist rather than a butcher's boy. "Well," he cried, and the water gushed along the pumptail, shooting clear of the side. On, an exuberant flood. In 30 minutes he was dripping sweat under the deck, and his wits were gathering themselves together through the clouds of Stephen's 5 and 30 drops. He recalled the events of yesterday, but without much emotion. On the edge of his field of vision, he noticed that the tide of wet, followed by sand, followed by holy stones, and then by swabs, was coming steadily aft. At length, he said, some zealous fool must have kept the sweetening cock open half the watch. Then he began to count his strokes. He had nearly reached 400 when at last there came the welcome cry, "She sucks!" They stood away from the pump brakes and nodded to one another, breathing hard. "The water came out as clear and sweet as Hobson's conduit," said one of his neighbours. "So it did," said Jack, and he looked about him. The surprise, still on the same tack but under topsails alone, had drawn in with Norfolk Island, so that the nearer shore could be seen on the rise, and along the heights the outlines of monstrous trees stood sharp against the sky, a sky that was as pure as ever, apart from a low cloud bank right astern, the lightest night blue overhead changing imperceptibly to aquamarine in the east, with a very few high clouds moving southeast on the antitrade, much stronger up there than its counterpart below. Down here the breeze was much the same as before, the swell, if anything, heavier. "Good morning, Mr. West," he said when he'd examined the logboard. "Are there any sharks about?" He handed the logboard back, it had told him exactly what he expected, and tossed his sodden nightshirt onto the rail. "Morning, sir, none that I've seen. Forecastle there, are there any sharks about?" "Never a one, sir, only our old dolphins." And as the cry came aft, so the sun sent up a fine brilliant orange sliver above the horizon. For a moment it could be looked at before eyes could no longer bear it, and a simile struggled for life in Jack's mind, only to be lost as he dived from the gangway, utterly forgotten in the long, bubbling plunge with his hair streaming out behind in the pure water, just cool enough to be refreshing. He dived and dived again, revelling in the sea. And once he came face to face with two of the dolphins, cheerful creatures, inquisitive but discreet. By the time he came aboard again, the sun was well clear of the sea, and it was full day, glorious indeed, though lacking that sense of another world entirely. There was Killick, too, standing by the stanchion with a large white towel and a disapproving look on his face. "Mr. Harris said it would close the pools and throw the yellow bile upon the black," he said, wrapping the towel about Jack's shoulders. "Is high water the same time at London Bridge and at the Dodman?" asked Jack. And having stunned Killick with this, he asked him whether the doctor were about. "Which I seen him in the sick bay," said Killick sulkily. "Then go and ask him whether he'd like to have a first breakfast with me." Jack Aubrey had a powerful frame to maintain, and this he did by giving it two breakfasts. A trifle of toast and coffee when the sun was first up, and then a much more substantial affair shortly after 8 bells. Any fresh fish that happened to be at hand, eggs, bacon, sometimes mutton chops, to which he often invited the officer and midshipman of the morning watch, Dr. Maturin being there as a matter of course. Stephen came even before Killick's return. "The smell of the coffee would bring me back from the dead. How kind to let me know, and a very good morning to you, my dear sir. How did you sleep?" "Sleep? Lord, I went out like a light and remember nothing at all. I didn't really wake up until the ship was pumped almost dry. Then I swam. What? Sure. I hope you'll join me tomorrow. I feel a new man." "I might, too," said Stephen without conviction. "Where is that mumping villain Killick?" "Which I'm coming as quick as I can, ain't I?" cried Killick, and then putting down the tray. "Jezebel's been rather near with her milk." "I'm afraid I shall have to leave you very soon," said Stephen after his second cup. "As soon as the bell strikes, we must prepare 2 patients for surgery." "Oh, dear," said Jack. "I hope it's not very serious." "Cystotomy. if there's no infection, and infection at sea is much rarer than in hospital. Most men support it perfectly well. Fortitude is called for, of course. Any shrinking from the knife may prove fatal. The bell struck. Stephen quickly ate three more slices of toasted soda bread, drank another cup of coffee, looked at Jack's tongue with evident satisfaction, and hurried away. He didn't emerge until quite well on in the forenoon watch. And as he came up, he met a usual mooring procession that had just reached the quarterdeck from the leeward gangway. Jemmy Ducks bearing three hen coops, one empty, Sarah carrying the speckled hen in her arms, and Emily leading the goat Jezebel, all bound for the animal's daytime quarters abaft the wheel. Greetings, smiles and bobs. But then Emily said in her clear child's voice, Mrs. weeping and wringing her hands way up forward. Stephen was thinking, how well animals behave to children. That goat is a froward goat and the speckled hen a cross ill-natured bird. Yet they allow themselves to be led and carried without so much as an oath. And it was a moment before he grasped the force of her remark. Aye, he replied, shaking his head. They moved on with their livestock, greeted by a great quacking of ducks already installed in a coop with legs. He was considering Miss Harville, the island, much closer now, its cliffs, its tall and strangely ugly trees, when he heard Jack cry, Jolly boats, crew away! And he became aware of the tension on the quarterdeck. All the officers were there, looking unusually grave, and from the forecastle and along the gangways the people gazed steadily aft. All this must have been in train for some time, since getting even a jolly boat over the side was a laborious business. The hands ran down to their places, the bowmen hooked on, and they all sat there looking up as boat and ship rose and fell. There's a Norfolk Island petrel, said Martin at Stephen's elbow. But Stephen only gave the bird a passing glance. Pass the word for my coxswain, called Jack.
Sir,
said Bondon, appearing in a moment. Bondon, take the jolly boat into the bay between the cape and the small island with the trees on it and see whether it's possible to land through the surf.
Aye, aye, sir.
You'd better pull in, but you may sail back.
Aye, aye, sir. Pull in and sail back it is.
Jack and Bondon had served many years together. They understood one another perfectly well. And it appeared to Stephen that in spite of their matter-of-fact words and everyday expressions, some message passed between them. Yet though he knew both men intimately, he couldn't tell what that message was. They pulled away and away, and once it had set a rise of the swell between itself and the ship, the jolly boat disappeared. Reappeared, disappeared, reappeared, smaller each time, heading straight for the land 2 miles away. Whitewater on the small island with trees close inshore to the east, whitewater between that island and the iron-bound coast, whitewater on the headland to the west, and the bay between had a fringe of white. Yet whereas all the rest of the coast in sight had cliffs dropping almost sheer, this bay possessed a beach, probably a sandy beach, running well back to a moderate slope, and there seemed to be a fairly clear passage in. They watched intently, saying little. But at 5 bells, Jack, turning abruptly from the weather rail, said, Captain Pullings, we'll stand off and on until the boat returns. And pausing on the companion ladder, he added, On the inshore leg we might try for soundings, before hurrying below. Phillips tells me that there are also parrots, parakeets, gannets and pigeons on the island. Said Martin, how I hope we may go ashore. If we cannot land on this side, do you think we'll be able to do so on the other? For once, Stephen found Martin a tedious companion. Was it possible that the man didn't know what landing on Norfolk Island might entail? Yes, On reflection, it was quite possible. Just as Captain Aubrey had been the last person to know that there was a woman aboard his ship, so Nathaniel Martin might be the last to know that this woman and her lover were in danger of being marooned there. The threat was, after all, very recent. The officers were unlikely to have discussed it in the gunroom, and it could scarcely have reached Martin from the lower deck. Martin had no servant of his own, and Pardine was hardly capable of telling him even if he'd wished to. On the other hand, it was possible that Martin, having heard of the threat, didn't take it seriously. For his own part, Stephen didn't know what to say. There were times when Jack Aubrey was as easy to read as a well-printed book, others when he couldn't be made out at all. And this formal public dispatch of the boat seemed to Stephen incomprehensible, in total contradiction with the cheerful, familiar, sea-wet Jack of early breakfast. The Surprise edged nearer to the wind, and Pullings gave orders for the deep-sea line. Stephen walked along the gangway to the bows. As he reached the forecastle, the hands gathered round the bits fell silent and slowly dispersed. From the rail, he had a perfect view of the bay, and his pocket glass showed him the jolly boat's crew pulling steadily in. They were more than halfway now. And as he watched, Bondon took the boat round a sunken rock with an ugly swirl of water over it. The ship barely had steerage way, and although the shrouds gave a creaking sigh each time the long swell raised her up or let her down, there was very little noise in the bows. He heard the cry of "Watch there, watch!" as each man in succession along the side let go his last turn of the deep-sea line, and then Reed's shrill report, 68 fathoms, sir, coral, sand and shells. Six bells. The boat had reached the edge of the breakers over by the small island and was working its way westwards along the shore. The triangular sail in front of him, the foretopmast staysail in all likelihood filled, and the Surprise began her turn, sailing gently away from the land. Martin, who could take a hint as well as any man, had retired to the mizzen top, which now commanded an excellent view of Norfolk Island, and Stephen thought of joining him there. But a disinclination for talk, combined with the exaggerated movement of the mast now that the ship was heading directly into the swell, kept him to the quarter-deck, where he stood at the taffrail and watched the jolly boat making its way towards the cape that limited the bay, keeping to the edge of the surf. From this level, the little boat seemed to be almost in the breaking rollers, and in great danger of being swamped. He was still there pondering when the jolly boat reached the far end, hoisted a sail, and stood out to sea. And he was so lost in his reflections that he was quite startled when Jack tapped him on the shoulder, saying with a smile, "You're in a fine study, Doctor. I hailed you twice. How did your patients do?" "I see," nodding at the dried blood on Stephen's hands, "that you've been opening them." "Quite well, I thank you. They are as comfortable as can be expected, and with the blessing they'll soon be more so." "Capital, capital. I shall pay them a visit." Then, in a much lower tone, he added, "I've been to the head myself. I thought you might like to know."
"I'm heartily glad of it," said Stephen, and asked him exact and particular questions.
But Jack Aubrey was more prudish than might have been supposed about such matters, and he only answered, "Like a horse, walking forward out of range." He brought the ship round again to meet the boat, but Stephen stayed where he was. With the turn, the island slid out of view to be replaced by a vast expanse of ocean. And today the ocean had a horizon as taut and sharp as could be desired, except in the west-southwest, where the early morning's cloud bank had grown, working up against the wind as thunderclouds and squalls so often did, contrary to all sense of what was right and natural by land.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Reed at his side, "but the captain thought you might like me to pour this water over your hand."
"God love you, Mr. Reed, my dear.
said Stephen. "Pray pour away and I will rub. I did wash it one time, I recall, but I dare say I adjusted a dressing afterwards. Fortunately, however, I turned back the cuffs of my coat or I should be in sad trouble with..." He stopped abruptly, for here was Bondon coming up the side. "Well, Bondon?" asked Captain Aubrey on the silent, listening quarter-deck.
"No landing, sir," said Bondon. "A wicked surf and a worse undertow, though the tide was on the ebb."
"No landing at all?"
"None at all, sir."
"Very good.
Captain Pulling, since there is no possibility whatsoever of landing, we will hoist in the jolly boat and make all possible sail on our former course." "On deck there," hailed the lookout at the masthead. "A sail right astern, fore and aft, I reckon." Jack took the watch telescope and ran aloft. "Whirl away, Trilling," he called from the cross trees. "Right astern, sir, on the edge of that ill-looking bank," replied Trilling, who had moved out along the yard. "I can't see her."
"Why, to tell you the truth, nor can I now, sir," said Trilling in that amused conversational tone more usual in a letter of marque than a man of war.
"She comes and goes like, but you could see her from the deck, was it to clear a little. She ain't a great way off."
Jack returned to the deck by way of a backstay, as he'd done when he was a boy.
"As I was saying, Captain Pullings," he went on, "we will make all possible sail on our former course. There's not a moment to be lost."
The jolly boat was hoisted in and made fast. The t'gallants were sheeted home and hoisted to the strange musical cries of the Orkneymen aboard. The bowlands hauled to the one chant the Royal Navy countenanced. 1, 2, 3, belay, oh! And Martin said to Stephen, "I was much astonished to hear that the surf made landing impossible. From my vantage point, I could have sworn I saw a relatively smooth stretch just this side of the cape. I hope you're not too deeply disappointed, Maturin."
"Faith, if I were to repine at every promising island I've been swept past in my naval career, I should have run melancholy mad long since. We have at least seen the mutton bird and the monstrous pines. Bad luck to them. I think them as ugly as they are tall, the ugliest vegetables known to man, except for that vile Araucaria imbricata of Chile, which in some ways it resembles."
They talked about the conifers they'd seen in New South Wales. They watched the upper yard men race aloft to set the royals. And Martin, looking round to see that no one was at hand, said in a low voice,
"Tell me, Maturin, why are they said to be set flying?"
"Flying? I've been at sea so long I don't like to ask anyone else."
"Martin, you lean on a broken reed. We are in the same boat, as reeds so often are. Let us comfort ourselves with the reflection that not all of our shipmates could tell how an ablative comes to be so very absolute on occasion."
"Sir," called West, who was standing on the leeward hammock nettings with a telescope, "I believe I make her out on the rise. I think she may be wearing a pennant. And if so, she's the cutter we heard about."
Pullings relayed this to the captain, adding, "When we were in Sydney, they spoke of a fast 14-gun cutter called the Eclair that was coming up from Van Diemen's Land."
"I heard about her," said Jack, trailing his telescope aft, "but I see nothing."
Noon. The officers took their altitudes. Pullings reported that the sun was on the meridian. Jack allowed that it was 12 o'clock and that the new naval day might now begin. 8 bells struck, the hands hurried to their dinner, and a curious noise they made, not the muffled anxiety of the day before, but still restrained and, as it were, conspiratorial. When the din was over, and when the hands were perhaps halfway through their dinner, oatmeal, ship's bread and cheese, Monday being a banyan day, West repeated that he was sure of the cutter now and almost certain of her pennant.
"You may be right, sir, though I see nothing of it," said Jack. "But even if you are, there's nothing extraordinary about a cutter being sent to Norfolk Island. There are still quantities of government stores ashore and several people, I understand."
"Surely they're throwing out a signal, sir," cried West a moment later.
"I don't see it, sir."
said Jack coldly. Besides, I have no time for idle gossip with a cutter. And Davidge, who was quicker than his shipmate, murmured, "Tasse is the Latin for a candlestick, old fellow." When the hands, and therefore the midshipmen, had finished their dinner, Jack went below and sent for Oakes. "Sit down, Mr. Oakes," he said. "I have been considering what to do with you, and although it's clear that we must part, apart from anything else, no women are allowed in the Surprise, I do not mean to discharge you until we reach some reasonably Christian port in Chile or Peru, where you can easily take the passage home. You'll have enough money to do so. There's not only your pay, but also the probability of some prize money. If we should take nothing, then I will advance what is necessary." "Thank you very much, sir." "I shall also give you a recommendation to any naval officer you may choose to show it to, mentioning your good and seamanlike conduct under my command. But then there is your companion. She's under your protection, as I take it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Have you considered what is to become of her?"
"Yes, sir."
"If you'd be so extremely kind as to marry her, she would be free. And if that cutter were to come aboard, we could bid them kiss up, or we could laugh in their faces."
"Have you made her an offer?"
"No, sir. I suppose then go and do so, sir. If she agrees, bring her back here and let me hear her confirm it. Be damned to hell if I allow any forced marriage in my ship. If she don't, we shall have to find some place for her to sling a hammer. Cut along now, you may be as quick as you like. I've many things to do. By the way, what's her name?"
"Clarissa Harville, sir."
"Clarissa Harville, very well. Carry on, Mr. Oakes." They came panting aft, and Oakes urged her through the cabin door. She'd heard of her lover's summons. She'd had time to do what could be done to clothes, hair, face, against all eventualities, and looked quite well as she stood there, slim and boyish in her uniform. Her fair head bowed. "Miss Harville," said Jack, rising, "pray be seated. Oakes, place a chair and sit down yourself." She sat, her eyes cast down, her ankles crossed, her hands in her lap, her back quite straight, looking as nearly like one wearing a skirt as possible. And Jack addressed her. "Mr. Oakes tells me that you might consent to marry him. May I take it that this is so, or is the fish rather to, that's to say, or does he flatter himself?"
"No, sir. I'm quite ready to marry Mr. Oakes."
"Of your own free will?"
"Yes, sir."
"And we shall be infinitely obliged for your kindness."
"Never thank me. We have a parson aboard, and it would be most improper for a layman to take his place. Have you any other clothes?"
"No, sir."
Jack considered. "Jemmy Ducks and Bondon could run you up a smock of number 8 sailcloth, the kind we use for royals and skysails. So perhaps," he went on after some thought, "canvas might be looked upon as improper, not sufficiently formal."
"Not at all, sir," murmured Miss Harville. "I have some old shirts, sir, that could perhaps be pieced out," said Oakes. Jack frowned, and raising his voice to its usual pitch, called, "Kinnick! Kinnick there!
Yep!
Rouse out the bolt of scarlet silk I bought in Batavia."
"Oh, dear, but we should have to rummage the whole aft to hold my mate and me with a couple of hands to heave and then put it all back again," said Kinnick. "Hours of heavy toil."
"Nonsense," said Jack. "It's next to the lacquer cabinets in my storeroom, packed in matting and then blue cotton. It'll not take you 2 minutes, even less." Kinnick opened his mouth, but weighing up Captain Aubrey's present mood, he closed it again and retired with an inarticulate grunt of extreme displeasure. Jack went on, still addressing Miss Harville. "But I'm sure you can sew perfectly well yourself."
"Alas, sir, only the plainest of seams with large stitches and very slows, scarcely a yard in an afternoon."
"That'll never do.
The gown must be ready by 8 bells. Mr. Oakes, there are 2 young men in your division who embroider their shirts uncommon pretty. Willis and Hardy, sir. Just so. They can each take a sleeve. Jemmy Ducks can run up a skirt in half a glass, and Bondon can look after the upper part. There was a pause. And to fill it, Jack, who was always rather nervous with women, said, I trust you don't find the weather too hot, Miss Harville. With squalls brewing astern, it often grows oppressive. Oh, no, sir, said Miss Harville, with more animation than her modesty had allowed hitherto. In such a very beautiful ship, it's never too hot. The words were idiotic, but the inclination to please and to be pleased was evident, and the compliment of the ship couldn't go wrong. Killick came in, so pinched with disapproval that he couldn't bring himself to say anything but, which I took off the matting. Jack said, thank you, Killick, turning the bolt in his hands. He opened the blue cotton wrapping, and the silk appeared. A heavy, discreetly gleaming silk, deeper than scarlet, extraordinarily rich in texture and, above all, in colour, with the sun coming diagonally across from the stern windows. Mr. Oakes, he said, carry this boat to Jemmy Ducks. It's a fathom wide and a suitable length, cut from the end square with the leech, will cover the young lady from top to toe. Tell Jemmy what's to be done and ask him whether there are any better tailors in the ship, and if so, to carry on with their help. There's not a moment to lose. Miss Harville, I hope to have the pleasure of seeing you at 8 bells. He opened the door. She made as though to curtsy, realised the absurdity, and gave him a most apologetic look, saying, I don't know how to thank you, sir. Lord, it's the most beautiful, beautiful silk I've ever seen in my life. The interview, though short, had been curiously wearing, and Jack sat at his ease for some time on the stern window locker with a glass of Madeira at his side. Through the open companion he could hear the usual sounds of the ship. Davidge, the officer of the watch, calling out for an even tauter foretopsail bowline. Dirty Edwards, the quartermaster at the con, telling the helmsman to ease her a trifle, Billy, then luff and touch her. And then Davidge again. I cannot tell you where to put it, Mr. Bulkley. You'll have to wait until the captain comes on deck. Jack finished his wine, stretched, and came on deck. As soon as he appeared, blinking in the sunlight, Davidge said, Sir, Mr. Bulkley wants to know where the hands can hoist the wedding garland. Wedding garland? Said Jack. And glancing into the waist of the ship, he saw several men from Oakes's division gazing up. As he looked, they mutely raised the traditional set of hoops, all decked out with ribbons and streamers. Where, indeed, was it to go? If Oakes had been a seaman, it would have gone to the mast he belonged to. If he had commanded the ship, then to the main topgallant stay, but in this case... Hoist it to the fore topgallant masthead, he called down and walked slowly aft. That garland had not been made during this last half hour. The streamers weren't even very fresh. The infernal buggers had known what he'd do, had foretold his decision, had made game of him. God damn them all to hell, I must be as transparent as a piece of glass, he said, but without any particular anger. In any case, his mind was diverted by the sight of Dr. Maturin showing Reed a series of extraordinarily exact and rapid steps from an Irish dance. There, he said, that is a way we have of tripping it at a marriage, but you must never wave your arms or show any emotion, far less hoot aloud. Some unhappy nations do a most illiberal practice. Here's the captain himself, who will tell you that hallooing as you dance is not at all genteel. It's an odd thing, said Jack when Reed had withdrawn, but I seem to bring no news in this ship. The hands have had the garland ready pretty well since we weighed, and here you are showing young Reed how to dance at a wedding, though it was arranged only 10 minutes ago. I doubt whether I shall even be able to astonish Mr. Martin when I ask him to officiate. He dines with us today, as I'm sure you recall. Oh, I wish he may not be late.
My belly fairly groans for its food, though that may be the effect of terror. You have noticed the ship pursuing us, I make little doubt. A ship flying a man-of-war's pennant. I pass over your calling a cutter a ship. But allow me to object to your pursuing. To be sure, she is sailing approximately the same course. And to be sure, she would probably like to speak to us. But she may very well be putting into a bay on the northwestern side, the leeward side of Norfolk Island, on some official business. And although she is alleged to be wearing a pennant, I believe I may safely ignore her. I've no time for gossiping, and we're sufficiently far apart for it not to be offensively obvious, not court-martial obvious. And we shall certainly stay far enough ahead until nightfall. Can we not outsail her? Run clean away? Of course not, Stephen. How can you be so strange? Both vessels are moving through the water at much the same pace, whereas we, as a ship, a square-rigged ship, can only come up to within 6 points of the wind. She can come up to 5. So all things being equal, she must overhaul us in the long run. Unless, of course, we put before the wind, which would put us far out of her reach, but which would also be a clear proof of criminal evasion. If she's still there in the morning, if she hasn't run into the lee of Norfolk Island, then if there's no extraordinary change in the weather, I shall have to heave too. To stop, he added, for a person who could call a cutter a ship after so many years at sea might need even simpler terms explained. But by that time Oakes's companion will be a free woman, Martin having done her business with book, bell and candle. You would never be forgetting Pardeen, I'm sure, said Stephen in a low voice. No, said Jack, smiling, I am not. We have no Judases aboard, I believe, and even if we had, it would be a bold cutter commander who would find him in my ship. For some minutes he studied the Eclair, the cutter in question, through his glass. She was well handled, and she might, in fact, be moving a little faster than the Surprise, as well as lying closer to the wind. And her pennant was now quite certain when she came about. But she couldn't reach him by nightfall, and the likelihood of her running beyond Norfolk Island into the main ocean was very small indeed, even if she was in pursuit of him. He closed the telescope and said, "It's a very surprising thing, you know, the power of a young woman that sits quiet, self-contained and modest, looking down and answering civil. Not like a booby, mark you, Stephen. Civil, but not very much. A man couldn't speak chuff to such a girl without he was a very mere goth. Oh, Jarvey couldn't speak chuff to such a girl. It is my belief, brother, that your misogyny is largely theoretical." "Aye," said Jack, shaking his head. "I love a wench, it's true. But a wench in her right place. Come, Stephen, we must shift our clothes. Tom and Martin will be with us in 5 minutes." In 5 minutes, Captain Pullings in all his glory and Mr. Martin in a good black coat walked into the great cabin. They were at once offered drinks to whet their appetite, a wholly unnecessary form at this time of the day, and as the bell struck they took their places at table. For the first part of dinner, both sailors tried to make both medical men understand, really understand, why a craft that came up to within 5 points of the wind must eventually overtake another, moving at the same speed but coming up only 6 points, it being understood that they were both sailing close-hauled. After the roast mutton had gone away, a very mere skeleton, Jack in desperation sent for Reed and told him to ask Mr. Adams for some Bristol card and to cut out 2 isosceles triangles, the one with an apex of 135 degrees, the other of 112 degrees 30 minutes. By the time triangles came, the cloth had been drawn, and Jack would have traced lines showing the direction of the wind and the turning points in port on the gleaming mahogany, had Killick not cried out, "Oh, sir, no, sir, if you please, let me stretch lengths of white marlin." The marlin stretched, Jack said, "Now, gentlemen, the wind is blowing right down the middle,
from the doctor's waistcoat to mine. The parallel lines on either side show approximately where the vessels go about, beating up into it towards him. Now I lay the six-pointer's triangle on the left-hand line with its base at right angles to the wind. I trace the ship's course, close-hauled as far as the right-hand line, where she goes about, and I mark the place with a piece of bread. I do the same for each leg until I reach the turning point of the sixth leg marked with this dead weevil. Now, I take the cutter's five-point triangle. I do the same. And as you see, the cutter's fourth leg coincides almost exactly with the frigate's sixth. The distance made good to windward is pretty well 4-3 in favour of the fore and aft rig.
It cannot be denied, said Stephen, looking closely at the weevil. But my head is more fully convinced than my heart. Such a fine, tall ship that has run down so many enemies of superior force.
Would a trigonometrical proof please you more? Asked Tom Pullings. Stephen shook his head and privately drew the weevil towards his plate.
I looked in a book on trigonometry once, said Martin. It was called A Simple Way of Resolving All Triangles, Invaluable for Gentlemen, Surveyors and Mariners, Carefully Adapted for the Meanest Understanding. But I had to give it up. Some understandings are even meaner than the author imagined, it appears.
At least we all understand this capital port, said Stephen. A glass of wine with you, sir.
By all means, said Martin, bowing over his plate. It is indeed capital port, but this must be my very last. I have a ceremony to perform within the hour, as you know, and I shouldn't wish to mumble and stumble my way through it. After dinner, Stephen, who attended no services but funerals, retired to the sick berth, where Owen told him about his voyages to the mainland and islands of northwestern America for furs, and thence across by the Sandwich Islands, particularly Hawaii, to Canton, or sometimes home by way of the Horn or the Straits, with perhaps a stop at Massafuera for sealskins. And about other parts of the South Seas he'd been to, especially Easter Island, which Stephen found more interesting than the rest, above all because of the prodigious figures on their exactly dressed stone platforms set up by an unknown people, who had also left records on wooden tablets inscribed in an unknown script and an unknown tongue. Owen was an intelligent, clear-headed man who took pleasure in measuring things and pacing out distances, and who, though nearly 60, still had quite a good memory. He was still talking, though rather hoarse by now, and Stephen was still questioning him when Martin came down for the evening doses and dressings.
"How I long to see Easter Island," said Stephen to him.
"Owen here has been telling me more about the place. Do you remember how far off it is?"
"I believe," the captain said, 5,000 miles.
But really the bottle passed with such insistence after the ceremony that I'm scarcely to be relied upon.
Padine, of course, was present as Lob Lolly Boy. He had been in a pitiable state of anxiety ever since the cutter was sighted. And now, as they all walked into the dispensary, he bent to whisper in Stephen's ear,
"For the mother of God, your honour will never forget me, I beg and beseech."
"I will not, Padine, upon my soul. I have the captain's word itself," said Stephen, and partly by way of reassuring him, he went on in an ordinary tone to Martin. "How did the service go?"
"Well, I hope."
"Oh, yes, I thank you. Apart from the pitching, which nearly had us over twice, it might have been a private wedding in a drawing-room. The captain gave away the bride very properly. The armourer had made a ring out of a guinea piece. All the officers were present, and everything was entered in the log and signed. The bride startled me by appearing in a scarlet dress, but she thanked me very prettily when I offered my congratulations afterwards."
"Had you not seen her before?"
"Certainly I had.
I went forward earlier in the day to speak to her about the nature of the ceremony and to make sure she understood it. I had supposed she was quite a different kind of woman, barely literate.
She was still wearing the clothes she had come aboard in, and I must say that although she looked very well as a bride, she looked far better as a boy. Her slight but not unattractive form gave me, if not an understanding of pederasty, then something not unlike it. Stephen was surprised. He'd never heard Martin make such an unreserved and almost licentious observation. Perhaps he was now more a medical man than a parson. And perhaps, Stephen reflected as they rolled their pills in Paddy and wound bandages, this was one of the effects of bringing a woman into a celibate community. He was no chemist, but some of his friends were, and he'd seen a Swedish savant let a single catalyzing drop fall into a clear, untroubled liquid that instantly grew turbid, separated, and threw down fire-red crystals. "Come," said Martin, "we mustn't be too late. There are to be great doings on the forecastle. Jack's alive, and hornpipes, of course, and some of the old dances, like Cuckold's All Awry, and An Old Man's a Bed Full of Bones. We used to dance them when I was at school. What could be more suitable?" said Stephen. The Surprise had always been a tuneful ship, and much given to dancing, but never to such a degree as this evening, when the crowded forecastle saw the ranks of country dancers advance, retreat, and caper in perfect time despite the swell, while fiddles, horns, jews harps, and fifes played with barely a pause on the bits, and even perched on the windward cathead. Hornpipes, with several dancing at once, each encouraged by his own division, jigs, the strange evolutions of the Orkney men and their rhythmic howls. "They're enjoying themselves, sir," said Pullings. "Let them gather their peascods while they may," said Jack. "Old Monday, he's a-dying. They'll have a ducking before we muster the watch." They both glanced up through the cloud of sails at the thickening sky. Barely a star showing through. "But I'm just as glad of it. That damn cutter'll throw up another blue light in a minute, but we shall not be able to see this one either." Indeed, as the current hornpipe was ending in feats of extraordinary agility, two faint blue glows appeared far astern, but the third, completing the conventional signal, couldn't be made out at all. "Even so," said Jack, "let's keep all standing at 8 bells. That fellow's sure to shorten sail for the night. He's not cracking on hot foot after some thumping great prize. Two escaped convicts without a penny on their heads are not a thumping great prize." "He might be after promotion, sir." "Very true. But taking two very small absconders wouldn't win him a ha'porth of promotion, whereas cracking on, being brought by the lee and limping home under a jury rig, would certainly earn him some very bitter words indeed, naval stores being what they are in Sydney. No! With t'gallants and royals, we shall draw so far away from him in the night that I don't believe even promotion would bring him on, supposing there were any. But in any event, I'm morally certain that in an hour's time he'll put down his helm and steer for the north side of the island." Jack paused, sniffing the air, taking in the whole vast series of strains and stresses acting on the ship. "Yet, with such a top hamper and the possibility of thick weather..." A double flash of lightning startled the dancers, and the first swathe of warm rain untuned the fiddle strings. "I should like you to take the middle watch." It was rare that Captain Aubrey misjudged a naval situation, but at first dawn the next day the thump of a distant gun drew him from his sleep, and a moment later Reed appeared in the twilight by his cot. "Captain Pulling's duty, sir, and the cutter is 1/2 mile on our starboard beam. She's thrown out a signal and fired a leeward gun, and she's lowering down a boat." "What does the signal say, Mr. Reed?" "We haven't been able to make out the hoist yet, sir, the light being so indifferent, but we think Governor and Dispatch is part of it." On deck, a somewhat drawn Pulling said, "I'm sorry to pull you out of your bed so soon after you turned in, sir, but there you are. She never reduced sail any more than we did. She cracked on to make all sneer again, and she must have crossed our wake about 4 bells. There's nothing to be done about it. Prepare to receive boarders as civilly as we can, flog the gangway and preddy the deck as far as possible. I shall put on a uniform.
Mr. Reed, you'll have to change those filthy trousers. They seem to be whipping an extraordinary number of objects over the side, he added from the head of the companion ladder. Below, he roused Stephen Matchonen and said, You may call me Jack Pudding if you choose, but that cutter's alongside and I must receive her captain. I shall invite him to breakfast. If you join us, pray do not forget to shave and put on a shirt, a good coat and your wig. Killick will bring hot water. He then roared for his steward, Uniform! Tell my cook to prepare a breakfast fit for visitors and to stand by in case they stay dinner. Pass the word for Bondon. And to Bondon privately, Stow Padine. Both Jack and Bondon had had a great deal of experience in pressing hands out of merchantmen, hands hidden often enough with wonderful ingenuity, and they were confident that no one, unless he were allowed to fumigate the ship with sulphur, could discover their hiding place. The boat came slowly across, taking care to row dry with so many packages aboard, and presently a lieutenant, followed by a midshipman, came aboard to the wail of bosun's calls. He saluted the quarter-deck, which returned the salute, and advanced with his hat tucked under his arm and a waxed sailcloth packet held in his left hand. Captain Aubrey, sir, he said. I am the Mullen, commanding the Eclair, and I've been ordered with orders from His Excellency to deliver this to you personally. Thank you, Mr. Mullen, said Jack, taking the official packet with due gravity and shaking McMullen's hand. And then, sir, I have a quantity of mail for surprise that came in two ships, one after another, just after you sailed. That'll be very welcome to all hands, I'm sure, said Jack. Mr. West, pray have it brought aboard. I hope, sir, that you'll breakfast with me. I should be delighted, sir, said McMullen, whose red, round young face, hitherto solemn and official, now beamed out like the sun. And Mr. West, said Jack, looking at the Eclair's long-legged midshipman on the gangway. I'm sure the gunroom will look after the young gentleman and see that the boat's crew have all they want. In the cabin, McMullen looked about him with the keenest attention, and on being introduced to Stephen, shook his hand long and hard, and in the course of breakfast he said, I'd always longed to be aboard the Surprise and to meet her surgeon, for my father, John McMullen, held the appointment in 99, the year of the Hermione. Yes, sir. And he told me all about it in such detail that it seemed almost like Troy with all the people and the places on the heroic scale. Mr. McMullen will correct me if I'm mistaken, said Stephen, but I can think of no more concentrated heroism in the Iliad. After all, the Greeks had 10 years in which to accomplish their feats. The Surprises in 1799 had not as many hours. I should be the last to contradict Dr. Maturin, said McMullen, for not only do I abound in his sense, but my father has always mentioned him with the greatest respect. He told me, sir, that he looked upon your Diseases of Seamen as the most luminous, perspicuous book on the subject he ever read. He flatters me far beyond my deserts, said Stephen. May I help you to a slice of bacon, sir, and a double-yolked, delicately browned egg? You're very good, sir, said McMullen, holding out his plate. And when he'd emptied it, he said to Jack, Captain Orbison, may I beg you to indulge me? I have undertaken to sail for the mainland in half an hour, and if I might spend those minutes in running about the ship with a midshipman, tops, fighting quarters and so on, and in looking at the sick berth for my father's sake, it would make me extremely happy. But ain't you going to stay to dinner? Cried Jack. Sir, I regret it exceedingly. Nothing would have given me greater pleasure, said McMullen, but alas, my hands are tied. Well, said Jack, and called Killick, Killick there. Which I'm just behind your chair, said Killick. Then pass the word for Mr. Oakes, said Jack with a look that meant tell him not to look too squalid for the honour of the ship. The moment Mr. McMullen had left the cabin with Oakes, Tom Pullings came in and said, Sir, the officers and men are very urgent with me to beg you'll open the mail. No more urgent than I am, Tom, said Jack, hurrying out onto the half-deck,
where there stood a surprising heap of boxes, chests and bags. With no pleasure, Jack recognised the bulk of it as legal papers in corded legal trunks. He heaved them to one side and seized the undoubted mail sacks. He broke the seals, emptied the contents onto the broad, wide stern window locker, and hurrying through them for Sophie's well-known hand, he called for his clerk. "Mr. Adams," he said, "pray sort these for me, will you? Those for the lower deck may go forward at once." He carried his own little heap and the official packet away to his sleeping cabin. There he opened the waxed sailcloth first from a sense of duty. As he had expected, it contained three large Admiralty enclosures for Stephen, together with a cover from the Governor. Compliments, no doubt, and then he laid them all aside for his letters from home. Dear Sophie had at last learned to number her envelopes, so he was able to read them in order. And this he did with a happy smile set on his face, and his soul 10,000 miles away, watching his son's progress in Latin under the Reverend Mr. Beales, and in horsemanship under his cousin Diana, a female centaur, and his daughters in history, geography and French under Miss O'Mara, in dancing, drawing and deportment at Mrs. Hawker's establishment in Portsmouth. Progress all more or less supported by notes in their own hands, proving that they were now at least partially literate. But the smile abruptly left his face when he came to a later reference to Diana, to their cousin Diana, Stephen's wife. Sophie had always been most unwilling to say anything disagreeable about anyone, and when it came to her cousin, the adverse criticism was so hedged about, qualified and softened, that its meaning was not at all easy to catch. Something was amiss. But a second reading didn't make it clear, and he had no time for a third before Oakes knocked at the door and said, "If you please, sir, Mr. McMullen wishes to take his leave." "Thank you, Mr. Oakes. Pray let the boatswain know." Jack came on deck and found McMullen poised to go, the Eclair lying to within pistol shot. "I thank you very heartily indeed, sir," he said, "and give you joy of the finest sixth rate I've ever seen, finer even than my father told me." They parted on the kindest terms. The cutter put before the wind and spread her wings. When last seen, she was setting t'gallant stunsails, tearing away to a young woman in the suburbs of Sydney. But long before this, Jack had returned to the great cabin, followed by all the officers, and when he'd handed round their post, he said, "Gentlemen, although Mr. Oakes may leave us at the next convenient port in South America, since the surprise carries no wives, in the meantime he remains a midshipman and must be treated by all hands with the respect due to anyone who walks the quarterdeck. The same, of course, applies to Mrs. Oakes. I intend inviting them to dinner, and I look forward to the pleasure of your company." They all bowed, said they would be charmed, delighted, very happy, and hurried off to read their letters. Jack, having passed the massive enclosures to Stephen, went back to his sleeping cabin, and he was about to return to Ashgrove Cottage and this question of Diana, when the Governor's envelope, addressed to Captain Aubrey, Royal Navy, MPFRS, etc., etc., struck him as larger than usual for even very flowery compliments. Yes, indeed. These were orders, wholly official and direct. And like most orders, they left the door ajar, so that the man who carried them out could be blamed for either closing or opening it. There had been trouble in Muahu, an island to the south of the Sandwich Group. British ships had been detained and British mariners misused. It appeared that there was a war in progress between the Queen of the southern part and a rival from the north. Captain Aubrey would proceed to Muahu without a moment's loss of time and take appropriate measures to secure the release of the ships and their crews. It appeared that the forces were evenly balanced. The presence of His Majesty's ship would no doubt decide the issue. On mature consideration, Captain Aubrey would decide which side was the more likely to acknowledge British sovereignty and receive a resident councillor with an adequate guard, and he would bring his influence to bear in favour of that side. It was desirable that there should be only one ruler for government to deal with. Although any unnecessary bloodshed was to be deprecated, if moral force proved insufficient to induce compliance, Captain Aubrey would consider other arguments. Oahu was, of course, British, Captain Cook having taken possession of the archipelago in 1779, and Captain Aubrey would bear in mind the importance of the island as a base for the fur trade between Northwest America and Canton on the one hand, and for a potentially far more important commerce with Korea and Japan on the other. He would also reflect upon the benefits likely to accrue to the inhabitants from British protection, a settled administration, superstition, barbarous customs, undesirable practices, medical instruction, enlightenment, missionary stations, commercial development. Jack's eyes skimmed over the usual set piece at the end, but he did notice that it had been written in haste, and that although the variation about the end justifying the means had been thought better of, there had been no time to write the whole afresh, and the words had been attempted to be scratched out, which gave them a ghostly emphasis. Oahu. Jack walked into the great cabin to the chart table, and having pored over it, he returned to the quarterdeck and said, "Mr. Davidge, we will alter course, if you please. Nor' nor' east, spritsail and spritsail topsail, the staysails I need not name." The guests, there were only seven of them, gathered in the coach. Normally Stephen's sleeping cabin, when he didn't prefer to go down to his little booth opening off the gun room and at all times his study, but now tweaked and scrubbed into the likeness of an anteroom. And when Stephen himself appeared, Martin said to him, "I'm so sorry about Easter Island." "So am I," said Stephen. "I was vexed to the heart when first the captain told me. But now I count it as just one more disappointment in a radically miserable life. And I console myself that the ornithology of these new islands has barely been touched upon. I understand that Oahu is no great way from Hawaii, which is known to possess a wide variety of honeysuckers and even a gallinule with a scarlet forehead." "Yes, and presently you will also have the consolation of seeing Mrs. Oakes in the remarkable scarlet gown I told you about." The door opened, but no scarlet gown appeared. The blue cotton that protected Jack's bolt of silk had been transformed by heaven knows what ingenuity and pains into a dress that looked very well with a seaman's black shore-going Barcelona handkerchief worn over it as a fichu. Jack stepped forward to welcome Mrs. Oakes and her husband, and in due course he led her, followed by all the rest, into the great cabin. It was more than usually splendid. For although the long table, ablaze with silver, was laid for eight and they spread well apart, there was still a great deal of space on every hand, a space filled with the sun reflected from the wake and the dancing sea, vivid and full of life, flooding in through the stern sash lights, a range of windows running across the whole width, a fourth and inwardly slanting wall of bright glass panes that made the cabin the most beautiful room in the world. Clarissa Oakes looked about her with evident pleasure, but she said nothing as he sat her on his right hand and the other chairs began to fill. Davidge was opposite her, and Reed was on her right with Martin over against him. Tom Pullings was, of course, at the foot of the table, with Oakes on his right hand and Stephen on his left. There were few seamen servants and no red-coated marines, only Killick behind Jack's chair, and his mates to carry dishes and bottles, Padin behind Stephen's, and a young foretopman each for Pullings and Davidge. But the scene had a seaman-like grandeur in which a 12-pounder on either side didn't look at all out of place. "We had an agreeable visitor this morning, ma'am," said Jack, helping her to soup.
the captain of the Eclair. He was most uncommon eager to see the ship because his father had served in her in 99, the year of her famous action at Puerto Cabello. Well, I say famous, a trifle of sherry, ma'am. It's a very innocent little wine. Because it made a great deal of noise in the service. But I don't suppose you ever heard of Puerto Cabello or the Hermione by land. I don't believe I ever did, sir. Though naval actions have fascinated me ever since I was a child. Please, would you tell me about Puerto Cabello? A first-hand account of a battle at sea would be of the very first interest. Alas, I wasn't there. How I regret it. I was indeed a midshipman in the Surprise at one time, but that was some years before. However, I'll give you a bold statement of the facts. Mr. Martin, the bottle stands by you, sir. Well, the Hermione was in the hands of the Spaniards, who at that time were our enemies, allied to the French. I'll not go into how they came to have her, because it's not to the point. But there she was, lying in Puerto Cabello on the Spanish main, moored head and stern between two very powerful batteries at the mouth of the harbour, yards crossed, sails bent, and all ready for sea. Captain Hamilton, Edward Hamilton, not his brother Charles, who then had the Surprise, took her in to have a look at the Hermione. She was a 32-gun frigate and 365 men aboard. The Surprise had 28 guns and 197 men and boys. But he decided to cut her out, and his people agreed. He had room for only 103 in his six boats, so he made a very careful plan of attack and explained it all as clearly as ever he could. An hour or so after sunset, and all wearing blue, not a scrap of white anywhere, they set off in two divisions, the captain in the pinnace with the gunner, a mid and 16 hands, the launch with the first lieutenant. Who was the first of the Surprise at Puerto Cabello, Captain Pullings? Frederick Wilson, sir. And the midshipman was Robin Clark, now master of the Arethusa. Aye. And then there was the jolly boat with another mid, the carpenter, and eight men. The next division was made up of the gig commanded by the surgeon, our friend M'Mullen's father, and 16 men, but I mustn't be too particular, six boats in all, counting the two cutters. So they pulled along, each division in tow, and each boat with a distinct task. The jolly boat, for example, was to board on the starboard quarter, cut the stern cable, and send two men aloft to loose the mizzen topsail. It was a dark night with a smooth sea and a breeze off the land, and all went swimmingly until they were within a mile of the Hermione, when they were seen by two Spanish gunboats rowing guard. "Be damned to them," said Hamilton. He cut the tow, gave three cheers, and dashed straight for the frigate, confident that all the rest would follow him. But some of them, eager to be knocking Spaniards on the head, set about these wretched gunboats, and Captain Hamilton and his boat's crew found themselves almost alone when they boarded on the starboard bow and cleared the forecastle. There was a tremendous din going on, and they found to their astonishment that the Spaniards were at quarters below them, blazing away with the great guns at some imaginary foe that had not yet arrived. So the Surprises made their way aft along the gangway for the quarter-deck, where they met with violent resistance. By now, the doctor and the gig's crew had boarded on the larboard bow, but forgetting that they were to rendezvous on the quarter-deck, they went for the Spaniards on the gangway and cut them up most dreadfully. But this left Hamilton alone on the quarter-deck, and four Spaniards knocked him down. Happily, some Surprises darted aft and rescued him, and a moment later the Marines boarded on the larboard gangway, formed, fired a volley down the after hatchway, and then charged with fixed bayonets. But there were a very great many Spaniards aboard, and it was still nip and tuck until the Surprises managed to cut the bower cable, whereupon they loosed the foretopsail, and with the boats towing, the Hermione stood out to sea. The batteries fired at her, of course, as long as she was in gunshot, but they only knocked away the gaff and some rigging, and by 2 in the morning she was out of range with all prisoners secured. In that bout, the Surprise had no one killed and only 12 wounded, though the poor gunner, I knew him well,
who steered the Hermione as she made her offing, was shockingly knocked about. The Spaniards, out of 365, had 119 killed and 97 wounded. Captain Hamilton was knighted, and after that the surprise was nearly always allowed a third lieutenant, an unofficial but a customary indulgence. "Heavens, sir, that was a famous victory," cried Mrs. Oakes, clasping her hands. "So it was, ma'am," said Jack. "Allow me to carve you a little of this soused hog's face. Mr. Martin, the bottle stands by you, sir." "But in a way your running fight, tearing down the channel, for example, in a heavy sea with all possible sail aboard, a lee shore within pistol shot, both sides evenly matched and both blazing away like Guy Fawkes' night, is even finer. Mr. Davidge, could you tell about the Amethyst and the Thetis in the year 8, do you think? Lord, that was such an action!" "Pray do, Mr. Davidge," said Mrs. Oakes. "Nothing could please me more." "A glass of wine with you, Mr. Davidge, while you collect your mind," said Jack, at the same time filling Mrs. Oakes's. "Well, ma'am," said Davidge, wiping his mouth, "in the autumn of that year we were close in with the coast of Brittany, the wind at east-northeast, to gallant breeze, when late in the evening we saw a ship, a heavy frigate she proved to be, slip out of Lorient, steering west by south. We instantly wore in chase." The tales followed one another, each amplified with details, names, accounts of various officers by the rest of the table, a fine general hum of talk accompanying but never breaking the central theme. And all this time Jack, true to the naval tradition, filled and refilled his guest's wine glass. While he was calling down the table, asking Pullings who it was that had taken the éclair in the first place, she said privately, "Mr. Reed, I'm sadly ignorant, but I've never dined with the Royal Navy before, and I don't know where the ladies usually retire." "I believe they do, ma'am," whispered Reed, smiling at her, "but not until we've drunk the King. And, you know, we drink him sitting down." "I hope I shall hold out till then," she said. And, in fact, she was still upright, steady, hardly flushed at all, and by no means too talkative, which could not be said for her husband, when the port came round and Jack, with a formal cough, said, "Mr. Pullings, the King." "Madam and gentlemen," said Pullings, "the King." "Well, sir," said Clarissa Oakes, turning to Jack when she'd done her loyal duty, "that was a delightful dinner. And now I shall leave you to your wine. But before I go, may I too give a toast? To the dear surprise, and may she long continue to astonish the King's enemies."